Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline. Liston Witherell.
Philip Morgan.
You know, I listened to the last episode of this podcast and I thought it had improved considerably from our previous efforts.
I think so too. You know, we released an episode on kind of what's prompting our retooling of Offline, but I definitely want to write about it too, because I think there's a lot of lessons in there that have taken me years, let's say, in order to learn through my business and through lots of failure that we've applied to making this better. So hopefully it is more than obvious to everybody listening.
I noticed you're going to start publishing daily to your email list, and I did a little fist pump when I read that.
I've been hemorrhaging subscribers since I started that.
Thanks, Philip.
Well, you know, they probably weren't that engaged to begin with.
Of course, that's what I believe.
And the folks, at the same time when I sent the email today that said, hey, I'm starting to publish daily, please leave. Like, this is your invitation to leave if that's too much for you. I had, I think, at least four people reach out and say, that's so awesome. I can't wait to start getting updates from you daily. Now, are those people paying customers? Not right now, but
they might be brand champions.
Exactly. Right.
To use a stupid marketing term for basically people who really dig what you're doing and talk about it with their friends and provide organic word of mouth.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I got a question. I'll give a tiny bit of context here in case it's interesting, because this will probably keep coming up. When folks opt into my email list, after they confirm that they want to join, they get popped over to a survey, a very short survey. All the questions are optional. And this little innocent survey has been so valuable. I ask folks things like, where are you in your career? What's your biggest question about specializing? And some other questions. And this has started to yield a database almost of ideals. I use these things that people ask questions about in my calls to action. And I'll say, would you like to learn more about? And then I'll kind of paraphrase someone's question. The survey is anonymous, so I don't know who asked the questions. And then occasionally, a question will serve as really great fodder for an offline podcast episode, or in this case, the first of several episodes that I think will form a sort of series. Let me read the question. Someone said they would like to learn or have me talk about high-level strategies on how to start the process of establishing yourself as an authority in your niche. Most everyone knows that being on podcasts, creating videos, and building an email list can be effective, but what are the pros and cons for each strategy? So that was the question. Pretty good question, I thought. And so that's our topic. We're not going to get through the whole topic because there are what? I wouldn't call them strategies, but how many approaches are there for building authority that you've got listed?
Well, yeah, I was going to say way more than I can name, but we've identified seven that I think are especially relevant in this context.
The Magnificent Seven. So we're not going to get to all those today, but I think we can set up some pretty worthwhile context and overview the list, and that'll probably be an episode. And then as time goes on, we'll dig into each one of these from the specific perspective of pros and cons. What's good, powerful, natural about this, whatever it is, emailing a list or guesting on podcasts, and where are its shortcomings? And I think that'll be useful information for folks. So as I was thinking about this episode, I noticed that in our notes, the word expertise popped up, but in the question, the word authority popped up.
Yes, indeed.
And I thought I would spend a minute pontificating about the difference between those two. And as I was writing some notes for this episode, a question from Quora popped up in my email inbox. The question was, why do so many high IQ people amount to nothing? Which I thought was very blunt and funny. And that sort of gets at what we're talking about today. If we think of expertise as similar to IQ, it's not. It's if you can be an expert in something and have a not very impressive intelligence quotient, I think anyway. But this question was sort of contrasting intelligence with success. And to me, that starts to kind of get at the difference between expertise and authority. You know, there are people who I think are not experts, but are authorities. And so that kind of raises the question, like, what's an authority and what's an expert? Can I throw that over to you, Liston, and say, what's your take on, like, what's an authority?
I was worried that this would devolve into a semantic discussion going into this.
Is it going there?
No, well, you assured me that it wouldn't. So I'll give you my quick take. So I think for the purposes of this discussion and for simplicity, authority is what's conveyed externally to you. Other people are putting their stamp of approval and saying, Liston or Philip or whomever is an authority in the space and we should pay attention to them. So essentially what it's doing is other people have agreed to some degree that you're someone who has specific and probably good or at least useful information about a specific topic.
Yeah, that's pretty close to how I would define it as well, as someone that some group of people, the group of people don't necessarily know each other. They maybe form some sort of kind of critical mass, but some group of people have agreed this is some person we're going to listen to on this subject, whatever it is. I don't know. Do you think Al Gore is an authority on global warming?
Yes.
So, I mean, he's not the only authority on that subject. He's not really a scientist, I don't think. But do you think of him as an authority? Is he a good example of someone who's an authority?
I think that's actually a great example of someone who's an authority, but not necessarily an expert within the field. There are other people who can give way more in-depth discussion and circumstance and reasoning about global warming than Al Gore can. Yeah. But Al Gore is in an authoritative position to spread the message.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting nuance. And already I think we've gone deeper than I thought we would go on this question. To me, expertise exists whether someone knows you're an expert or not, but authority can't exist without other people seeing you as an authority.
Yes, I agree. Expertise is really something that happens within yourself. You develop it, and maybe other experts in your field would recognize your expertise if you were speaking directly to them. But authority also implies reach and sort of a marketing success.
It's just occurring to me now. I had initially sort of defined expertise as, yeah, it can exist in isolation from anything. Someone's an expert in repairing car engines. They don't need other people to know about it for them to be able to repair car engines or whatever their expertise is. There's plenty of forms of expertise that can exist without others knowing about it. But that reminded me, the next thing that I think is critical about expertise is that it has economic value. I'm not dismissing expertise that has no economic value, but it just doesn't help you very much in a business context if that expertise has no economic value. And this podcast, after all, is about reaching people online so that they can pay for your expertise, or building an expertise-driven business that functions online. So expertise that doesn't involve other people is, I think, not the kind of expertise we're talking about. And so that really raises the question, if you have expertise but not authority, you might want the authority part because it might help you find clients. And I think that's why we're talking about this topic.
Yes, and it also may help you charge higher rates and improve the spread of your message. And there's all kinds of other reasons. So yeah, that was kind of the nature of the question, is like, what if I'm really awesome at this thing, but no one knows about it? How do I go about building my authority within my niche, is what the person was asking. And that, my friend, is a very large question. And so within the question, this person, she or he, I don't know which, rattled off.
I don't either, because it's anonymous.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, go ahead.
Let's say they rattled off a couple options, right? Being on podcasts, creating videos, building an email list. All of these things can be effective. What are the pros and cons of each? And so what I'd like to do in this episode is just 30,000 feet, kind of go over what's the high level view of what each of these different channels, and we've included more than were listed in the question, but what's the high level view of each of those channels, pros and cons? And then later on, we'll dig more into each individual one.
Great. I give you permission to do this for the rest of the episode.
Oh no, you're not going to, so you're done. You're clocked out now.
Yeah. I'm just going to go take a break and I'll keep the call going, but no, I'm kidding. I'll pipe in from time to time.
Let's keep you involved right off the bat with something you know a lot about, which is email marketing. So first of all, let me preface this by saying as a marketer, the first thing I'm always thinking about is what's your goal? So part of, before we even get to the pros and cons of these channels, I think the thing you should be answering before you're saying, should I podcast or should I create videos or whatever choice you have in front of you, rather than focusing on the channel, just figure out what is your goal? Like, why do you want to build authority and where are those people? So I won't beat that to death, but let's go to email marketing. So you and I are both very big on this, but you're much more experienced with it than I am. And the two things that come to mind immediately when I think about email marketing in terms of pros, and we're going to have to move fast through these, but the two things that come to mind are one, it's owned. You own that email list, and for a pretty low price, you have permission to email those people unlimited amount every day, every month, however often you want to do that. Yeah. And secondly, it's pretty easy and inexpensive to get started.
Both true. Just elaborating on the aspect of it where you call it, you say it's owned. Yes, you own your email list. You are not totally free from algorithms that are going to insert themselves in between you and your recipient or your audience. I think it's better to think in terms of individual recipients. One of the things people will say about social media is like, well, there's this algorithm interfering with your ability to reach your audience, which is true. And that's also true in email. Like, I don't want to paint an unfairly rosy picture of email marketing, but it's a relatively simple algorithm. It's basically just trying to find people who are truly spammers and keep them out of inboxes. Gmail gets a little more fancy than that, but not much more. So yeah, you own it. It's portable. Perhaps the email marketing service, I guess we will name some names here, Drip, has just been turning into something more and more of my expert friends are just eager to get away from. They're having deliverability issues, which all email marketing providers have, but they seem to be doing a worse and worse job of managing the software that LeadPages bought from Rob Walling, and now they just seem to be trying to turn it into some kind of garbage fire. So, dumpster fire.
They also just significantly raised the price, so it's less affordable than many great alternatives. But that aside,
yeah, the point being, you can move your list. It's portable.
You can move your list. And I also wanted to mention, in terms of the attention that you can command, sure, you can make arguments that if your email goes to the promotion tab in Gmail, it's not that valuable. I don't totally agree with that because my recipients still see my name on a daily or weekly basis, which has value in and of itself. But people check their inboxes constantly. I mean, the average person opens their cell phone, I think it's like 40 times a day. And that for the average person is probably evenly split between, say, messages, social, and inbox. So the likelihood that you're going to reach someone in their inbox is enormous.
Yeah. Also on the pro side of things, credit Jonathan Stark for sort of framing it this way. But one of the things that's amazing about email is it's a broadcast medium when you're sending. You can reach essentially an unlimited number of people with an email broadcast, however many are on your list, whether that's 20 or 200,000. So it's like a broadcast medium in that way. And then as soon as someone clicks the reply button, it converts into this intimate one-on-one conversation. That is kind of magical. I can't think of another medium like that, honestly. Social media doesn't work that way. So as soon as you say something in this broadcast that can reach many, that resonates with someone, they can click reply and all of a sudden the context has changed. And it's this intimate thing where they can share details and tell you things, what's going wrong in their business, and seek your advice or help. And I think that's very powerful for relationship building. And then the other thing, which I'm kind of ripping from your notes here, my friend, is the element of time. I just think that's the other thing that's so powerful about email marketing is it gives you the ability to build a relationship over time. Unlike something like an event where someone might show up and then not see you after the event, with email, the timing is sort of up to you. again, it's not guaranteed that you're going to show up in someone's inbox every time you click send, but there's this ability to just kind of show up over time, which lets you sort of drip, 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 wearing a drip of water wearing away a stone or something. You can help people see things differently. You can educate over time. You can help them build up the courage to tackle a difficult change. You can do all these things that the drive-by experience of them reading one blog article or hearing you once doesn't have that benefit of time amplifying the power of your message the way with email it does. Because, sure, some people will join your list and get one email from you and hit unsubscribe, but what's much more normal in my experience is they stick around for a while. They sort of hear you out in a way that they may not be able to in other media. So I know we're running a little long on email. You picked the wrong guy to ask about the pros of email because I have a lot to say about that. Let's keep it moving.
I'm going to have to cut you off faster next time. So on the con side, one thing that immediately comes to mind is you have to have something to say regularly. Email tends to work best if you show up in a repeated and regular interval. And of course, Philip, I know what you're going to say. The more you do it, the more things you have to say. And especially if you make a commitment, you're more likely to have more things to say. Definitely true, but I think that that can be a daunting bit of it. And I think the biggest thing for everybody is it's difficult to build a list. We talked in the last episode about your experiment was that the last episode or two ago? I can't remember.
That was actually our most recent episode. Yeah.
So your 135 experiment, it is difficult to build a list, even for those of us who are experienced doing it. For me, I would say it's difficult. I get better at it over time, but it is quite difficult. And there's sort of a momentum factor there too. So it's going to start slow and hopefully you get the flywheel working and you can increase the velocity over time. So that's something to keep in mind. Let's move on to podcasts, since we're on a podcast right now.
I was going to joke that I don't know of any cons at all with email, but I missed my timing on that. I'm such a fan of it. Yes, moving on to podcasts.
Well, maybe I'll be the bearer of bad news when we do the episode. I'm obviously mostly a fan of it. But yeah, so podcasts, there's a theme here, which is both emails and podcasts, they're owned by you. Yeah. So the nice thing about a podcast is I'm not dependent on a place nearly as much that makes up the rules in order to give me listeners, with one big caveat, which is iTunes. So about 60% of all podcast listeners are listening through an Apple device and through the iTunes store.
Yeah.
You mentioned the algorithm with email. That's a consideration. I think the other bigger consideration than that is maybe not on the con side, but just like heads up, you have to be pretty well spoken in order to regularly be interesting on a podcast.
Is that your way of firing me from offline?
Was it smooth or no?
Well, I mean, message received. yeah. How much severance pay do I get?
You didn't catch that Easter egg in our notes that I've placed in there?
I was at this event last week that David Baker puts on every year on positioning and lead generation, and he invited me to be there and just sort of help out, which was very cool, and it was super fun. And his podcast producer was there, a guy named Marcus. And the more people like that I hear talk about podcasting, the more I start to think, it's so great. And it's not the tip of the spear. It's not the place you start for, let's say, audience building. And I know that's not per se what we're talking about, but audience building and building authority kind of go hand in hand, because the bigger your audience is, the more people can start to see you as an authority and spread the word and so forth. So it doesn't mean that you have to have a big audience, but it kind of helps.
I'm of a couple different minds of this one. So
can I just say one more thing? So the consensus seems to be from these people who are basically like podcast producers for people like us. So they're producing 10, 20, 50 shows like offline. So they get to see a lot more data points than we do. And they seem to be saying, it's great, but it's not your primary way of growing an audience. And anyway, that's the most clear version of what I can give of what I was trying to say. You were about to say before I so rudely cut you off.
Yeah, maybe we should have Marcus on here to talk about that. That could be an interesting episode. What I was going to say about podcasting is it's a big category unto itself. So you could produce your own. You could be a guest on others. You could create solo episodes with the sole intention of creating authority and then driving traffic to your podcast, which I do. You could do interviews with other people, which is less authority building. It's more of like the halo effect. If you're around other authoritative people, then you must be an authority to some people. So I think it's a pretty broad category, but the one thing, well, I keep saying the one thing. I have lots of things to say about podcasts.
The next one thing.
The next thing that is going to come out of my mouth is that in terms of rich media, in terms of the amount you have to invest versus the value that you get out of podcasts, in my opinion, it is light years ahead of every other type of rich media. Because there's something about the voice. Most of us can recognize voices as well as faces. And it conveys a lot of trust. And the density of information that comes through in a podcast, it's not as high as reading, because obviously you can read a lot faster than I can talk or than you can listen to this. However, you get a sense of whether or not you trust me, of whether or not you like me. There's a personality and a level of information that comes across on the human level in audio that just will never come across in written form.
Yeah, the research I have seen on comprehension of the spoken word is that most people can comprehend at a multiple of the rate at which people speak. So, I mean, to me, that's why podcast player apps have multi-speed functionality, but at least 200%. Again, comprehension, you might not enjoy it. You might feel like you're running to keep up.
Right.
So there's some ways that folks can kind of tweak that. I just could not agree with you more, though, that it just has this almost magical ability. If you meet a few prerequisites for the content and your ability to not be totally weird on a microphone, it just has this magical ability to connect and build trust. And yeah, I think if we haven't talked about this before, we're going to talk about it again when we go deeper into this. So we probably don't need to dwell on this much more.
So in terms of the cons on podcasts, the pain that I've had, and I think I've been pretty vocal about, is that it's quite difficult to grow an audience. And that's partially because of the ownership factor. It's also partially because of the medium. You're listening, and so you're not actively staring at your device, and the word of mouth is much more difficult. No one's figured out the sharing part of podcasts yet, at least not well. I would also say focusing on quality. This is probably true of any content you create, but I find if you really want to get your podcast to the level, like the highest level, let's say This American Life or some of the Gimlet shows, like Without Fail is a wonderful interview-based show. Masters of Scale, the Reid Hoffman show. To get to that level of quality, it's not going to take 50% more effort. It's going to take like 5,000% more effort. And so really getting to a very high level of production quality is probably out of reach for most people if they still want to run a business that's not a podcast.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the good news to temper that just a bit is that that absolute upper echelon of production quality is not like vital, but depending on what you're trying to do, it could be important. But for a lot of us, that sort of middle ground, the upper edge of that middle ground is, I think, acceptable. And yeah, you pointed out what I was trying to point out, which is that as a like an audience growth tool, it's sort of problematic. And the same things that make it problematic, I believe, are what makes the medium of podcasting so great. Other than iTunes, there's really no centralized. It's not like Netflix, where if you want to release a movie now and you're not going to distribute through Netflix, you have to ask yourself, like, why? Because Netflix owns such a huge part of the audience. There's no audience aggregator or owner in the podcasting world. There's plenty of businesses that are trying to become that. And God help us if they do, because I think it will ruin the medium. But yeah, that's podcast nerd talk. Let's move on.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but there's no danger of that right now. It's a very sort of disaggregated, distributed way of consuming media. So next up, we have writing. And we'll use that as a broad category to include articles and books, not emails. And I am huge on this. So as an expert, let's set aside the authority part of it for a second. This will deepen your expertise. It will clarify your thoughts. It will help you distill and formalize all of the things that you tell clients on a regular basis. But when someone asks you, how would you tackle this problem? You don't have a great answer because you've just never taken the time to organize it. Writing is one of those things that'll just basically make you better at every other type of content that you create.
Yeah, I would say for any form of expertise, I'll just take myself as an example. That's more fair. There's maybe 100 people out there who have expertise similar to mine. Many of them are better than me. But and I'm not saying that this is true of anybody, but if that's true and they're not taking the time to write, I'm going to kick their ass in the authority world because I am taking the time to write. So again, it kind of gets back to, well, expertise is important. It sure matters. But if your goal is expertise plus authority, there are things that give you an edge. And you're absolutely right, Liston. I think that writing is one of the most potent ways of magnifying the power of your ideas, increasing the clarity of those ideas. If you take the most generous view of authority, it's like you become an authority so that you can help people. Like, I think Al Gore has become an authority on global warming, not because like that's what he wanted to do when he grew up, but because he's like concerned about this issue and he wants to make a difference. And I think that's the best motivation possible for building authority. And so if that's your motivation, then you're going to say, well, what are the tools I can use to create that impact that I want? And writing is a very powerful one. Even in today's quote unquote video dominated world, writing is still so powerful.
Well, it's interesting if you look at other authorities or experts in marketing, the video people say no one reads books anymore. And the writers say videos are the worst form of communication.
Right.
The email people say don't do social, they own it. And then the social people say no one's on email anymore.
Yeah.
So, like that.
Yeah, you've spotted my bias here.
Well, I wasn't picking on you. All I was simply saying is everybody has a strong opinion about this, but let's go with the Al Gore example. When he is on sort of a media blitz, there's a book, there's a movie, there's a webinar, there's a slide deck, there's all these different forms.
Yeah.
My guess, though, is it all starts with writing, with an article or a manifesto that then becomes a book that then gets turned into all of these other forms of media. Because writing is that indispensable clarifying step in order to get to any other form of media that's engaging.
I'd love to know. There's this wonderful client in my program, the Expertise Incubator, and he's an expert on thought leadership. And he has found that if writing is preceded by some sort of structured conversation, then the writing gets better. So I'm not throwing that out as an exception to what you said, just as an interesting additional detail that I think for some people, what you said is true. And if they precede that, like trying to articulate it through their spoken voice before they write, then the writing goes better. So I think really I'm talking about writing workflow maybe more than anything, but I just can't help but mention that because it was interesting. And I guess that gets to some of our cons, doesn't it, about writing?
Well, yeah, and before I get there, I did want to give a personal example. So I record a solo episode of my podcast every week, which will now be released under the banner Modern Sales.
Nice. That was available?
I know. Weird, huh?
Oh, make sure you buy all the domain names before this goes out. I'm just struck sometimes at how like really great names are still available.
It could not be my banner brand name because there is some competition, but there's no Modern Sales Podcast, which is shocking.
Now there is. That's great.
Anyway, it's going to be called Modern Sales. And anytime I sit down to record an episode of that, I sit down and write. I sit down and write the intro. I do research. I have probably like 1,000 word outline before I ever record anything. And so that's how important writing is like, even if you're going to be podcasting or recording videos, there's no way that you can escape the writing portion of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's go to the cons here. So I think the biggest challenge for me personally with writing is it takes forever to write well.
It is time consuming. Yes, indeed. It's also it depends on where you set the bar, right? But it can be demanding. Like if your thinking is sloppy, maybe if you're talking to a friend, they're grading you on a curve, or you can sort of like muddle your way through something. But in writing, all those shortcomings become very apparent. This is especially up in my face right now because I'm working on revising the positioning manual. It would be the version 3 of that book and perhaps the final version of it. And as I'm working my way through the draft, it's just like, feels like wrestling an octopus or something. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy. And I understand why a lot of people resist doing it. I guess my solution to that is I just lower the bar and I force myself to publish. Now it's, I don't know if you noticed listening over the weekend, I switched to 7 days a week.
I did see that.
So I just force myself to do it a lot and practice little small chunks. So rather than thinking about like someone who's a classical guitar player, rather than playing the whole piece, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to play this one passage of the piece over and over and over again until I get that down and then move on to the next one. It's kind of like that. So there's ways to deal with these challenges, but they are real challenges for sure. I see in your notes here, writing a book is hard work. What do you mean by that, Liston?
Gosh, we don't have time to cover that one.
No, we don't. But maybe when we dive into this topic.
Yeah. But the thing I would say about writing is it's obviously going to be the underpinning to everything else that's on this list. Yeah. So if there's any one thing that I would say you can't escape building your authority without this, it's writing. I just don't know of a way to do it without it. Now, some people, I'm reading the book right now, Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins, who's like an endurance athlete and sort of known as like the toughest man in the world. And I believe he dictated most of the book with a ghostwriter, but still he spent 8 or 10 months working on it. I mean, he didn't write the words, but yeah, he was part of the interviews and reviewing it. And you're just not going to completely escape this part. So I think that that's something to be conscious of. The last thing I want to say about writing and especially distributing your writing online is it's very difficult and competitive. So we'll talk a lot about that later, but harder and harder to get noticed through the written word. Speaking. So in terms of the absolute most powerful way to generate authority with the people in a room and leads with the people in a room in an expertise-based business, I have to say hands down has to be speaking.
I would agree. I did a thing. You can go to trustvelocity.com and look at this list of lead generation approaches that I vetted and profiled. And for the reasons you just indicated, it comes out at the top of that list as like the fastest way to do two things at once, to generate a lead who trusts you a lot, even if they never knew of you or saw you or heard you before they saw you speak or they witnessed you speak, then they're going to come away. Again, if everything is right, they're going to come away like being willing to let you babysit their kids or something. They're going to come away trusting you a lot and converting into a lead if all those things line up. And there's just not a lot of other things on our list that have that kind of power, I think. And it's led me, tell me what you think of this, Liston. We should explore this more, but it's led me to have a sort of theory, which is when you do things that are socially risky or risky to your status, they make it possible to generate trust more quickly. So a client is furious at you. You respond by email or you pick up the phone and call them. I think the calling is more risky and therefore it gives you more ability to rebuild trust in that situation. You could generate a lead by writing a really wonderful article, or you could get up on stage in front of people who might criticize you or think you look weird or see you sweating or whatever. Which of those is more socially risky? It's getting up on stage, right? That's why I think it's so feared. And I think that's where its power comes from. Anyway, that's a bit of a sideline. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
I think that's part of it. I think there's a little bit of the message is the medium at play with speaking. Like important people are the only ones who get in front of crowds is sort of the assumption that most of us operate off of.
Yeah, we assume there's a curator making sure it's worth our
time. Right. Like, Philip is here speaking. Like, Philip must be amazing because I trust this conference organizer and therefore Philip must be great. And people aren't consciously thinking that, but it contributes to their overall perception of you, which I think is really valuable. And you and I both know Carl Sakis, CarlSakasandCompany.com. I don't know. Google it and you'll find it. S-A-K-A-S.
Yeah. A very Googleable person.
Speaking is one of the, I think the actually the primary way that he's developed his coaching business is attending live events and speaking at live events. And so certainly there are lots of people who build their business. I recently interviewed a guy who had a $23 million acquisition of his consulting firm. And speaking is one of the primary ways that he's developed his authority within his space. So it's huge. The cons, however, the travel sucks and is quite expensive. Often the conference isn't going to pay for you to travel because they say, what about all the great marketing benefits? You also have to ask to be picked. So you can sit down and write an article right now. You could record a podcast. You could post on social. There's all these things where you don't have to ask permission. Whereas at a conference or any speaking event worth your time, you're going to have to ask permission and seek approval, which is kind of a pain in the ass and not my favorite thing to do.
Right. And there are things I used to think of as hacks that make it easier to do that, like try to find some topic that's really relevant, but no one else is talking about. And then I realized, well, those aren't hacks. Those are just basically how you make yourself relevant is by noticing the context in which you're operating, which as a 20-year-old, that was not a skill that I had. And now in my 40s, I can start to see, oh, that's nothing special. You're not cheating. You're just like, you're doing it the right way.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah, you're right. You got to be picked, but it's not that mysterious. I don't really know what to compare it to. It's actually not that hard to get picked if you just pay attention and you figure out the process. And I think we maybe can talk about that when we get to the episode where we dive into this. Like, it's not a big mysterious thing where it's like, whoa, why did they get picked? It's pretty obvious why the people who get picked get picked. It's because they know how to play the game, and the game is not that complicated.
Well, let's put it this way. It's not like getting into Harvard. It's not that hard, or getting into Stanford, but it is a little bit like applying to college in that there are more applicants than spots typically. And so you have to be picked.
Right. And your pregame is not, you don't start thinking about this 5 minutes before you fill out the application. You've been thinking about this for a year or two and structuring your activities so that you can get picked to speak at Unbounce or Inbound or whatever conference you're wanting to go to.
And I think what you just said, this is the last point I want to make, is that there's a time-intensive application process, but also the lead time is phenomenally long. So typically, you're going to have to apply to be on stage 6 months before the conference. Yeah. So you're really going to need an annual or even semi-annual planning process for this to make any sense and for it to have any impact generally. So keep that in mind.
But all of our listeners are playing the long game anyway, right, folks at home?
Indeed.
So that's not a burdensome requirement for them.
Let's move to video. I'm pretty big on video with some pretty big caveats in there. But other than live speaking and live interaction, video has the highest density of information transfer versus any medium. So I talked about the benefits of voice in podcasting. Video comes with the added benefit that they can see you as well, which could increase the amount of trust that you're building. And I think that that's a really big factor. I think also video content can be pretty sticky in terms of engagement. So I'll come clean about something. I like to watch comedy podcasts on YouTube. Like, I'll kind of have it in the background while I'm doing something else, and I'll kind of flip in and out. And I'll typically like go through the whole thing, which can be an hour or 2 hours sometimes. And I think that that's a pretty normal experience for people watching video. But video, my friend, is not for the beginner and not for the faint of heart. So let's quickly move to the cons here, because I think the cons are massive.
Yeah, it is a demanding medium for sure. So is that why your daily emails are so weird? Is because you've got comedy podcasts going in the background?
Are they weird?
I'm just giving you a hard time listening. Okay.
I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't towed the line at all here.
I was just totally trying to give you a hard time. So at this event last week, I met this guy. So he was at Second City, you know, Second City, right?
In September, I caught a show at Second City. Yeah.
He was the former CEO. Now he is helping introverts use what he's learned about comedy and kind of showing up and using your body and like all these things that contribute to really excellent sort of presence either on a stage or in front of a camera. Like, he coaches folks on how to apply that stuff. That's the bridge, I hope, to the cons, in that I see video as this really demanding medium. It's like your eyeballs moving a few degrees off center can send a message that you didn't intend to send if you're looking into a video camera. I always think about, who's the guy? This is a compliment, so I'm going to say his name. Who's that Infusionsoft agency that we often talk about?
Brad Martineau. I just interviewed
Brad Martineau. Yeah. That guy is like impressive in how he shows up on video.
Dude,
like,
he is so good.
Yeah, I know. Maybe he was born that way. I'd say there's a 2% chance he was born that way and a 98% chance he said, I want to be good on video and I'm going to work at it. And so he's making this really great eye contact with the camera. And it's just like arresting. So I think being that good at video takes serious commitment. And that's either a pro or a con. You can think of it as a pro if you're like, well, that's a way I can differentiate myself and stand out. And it's a con if you're like, well, I want to be good at video and I don't want to have to do the work.
Yeah, agreed. I think the biggest demand for video, and this goes along with what you're saying, is think about all of the video that you've watched in your entire life. 98% or more of it was for entertainment. For one reason or another, but mostly it's like Netflix and HBO and TV shows and movies.
And fail army videos.
Do you watch those?
Sometimes. They're one of my guilty pleasures.
My wife and I have seen every fail army video put out over the last like 3 years. We love.
Don't advertise that. I want this podcast to succeed. Please don't advertise.
Okay. Well,
no, I'm kidding.
I thought we're being honest here. This was a no bullshit show. So I'm just coming clean.
Now we have something in, I mean, I don't have that exact commitment in common with you, but I do find those videos super hilarious.
They're amazing, right? And it just sort of goes to show is like, fail army videos are basically nonstop entertainment. Every five to 10 seconds, there's a punchline.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be making video, sure, you can do talking head videos, but I would even argue a year ago, those weren't popular on LinkedIn. Now people are starting to really feel over it. And so now there's demands to like have screen interaction or change locations and video, forget even the technical aspects of it, the lighting, the sound. We haven't even covered that.
Yeah.
Just the body language and making eye contact and being interesting on camera in a repeated way, like every 5 to 10 seconds. It's a big challenge for most people. So it's not for beginners is what I would say.
Yeah, I see in your notes here, it's the closest thing to being naked. And yeah, I mean, it's because that camera is not blinking. It's not looking away when there's an awkward moment. It's like revealing all of that. It's like probing it.
Right.
Yeah, it's demanding medium for sure.
Demanding medium. So social is the next thing I have on here. For pros, the obvious one is that's where the people are. So Facebook has over 1 billion users. LinkedIn has 550 million user accounts. About half of those are active monthly users. And about half of that half, so a quarter, they claim are weekly users. So there's a lot of people on social. It's a way faster track to distribute your content and your thinking and your expertise and start to build some authority. And it can lead to one-to-one interactions. So you were talking about Jonathan's idea, which I agree is like just so smart. Like, why didn't I think of that? When he was talking about how email is both a broadcast medium, but also a one-to-one communication medium.
Right.
Social can be that, depending on how you do it. Yeah. But you can have permission basically to move from a broadcast to a one-to-one. It's sort of implied in the medium. But here's the downside. Because there are so many people there and the social network's only goal is to keep you from ever leaving, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, they're all like Hotel California. You can check in, but you can't check out. That's what they want.
That does seem to be their number one KPI is like time spent on site per user or whatever. So yeah, that seems to be the case.
Well, it's an advertising business.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that's a lack of creativity. I think that's just like the nature of the medium or the nature of the monetization model.
Yeah. I think it's the nature of the model because similar with TVs is the same exact way. They don't want you to turn the TV off or change the channel. That's why they invest so much in content. Yeah. So the big con for me, and one of the reasons I've pulled back significantly on LinkedIn, and we can dive more into this when we record an episode on social specifically, is that there's a big influx of content created there, which means it's harder and harder to gain attention. At the same time, the networks don't want you to leave. And so they're only going to show people the content it thinks they will engage with. So what do people engage with? They engage with stuff that stirs controversy, makes them angry, or otherwise pisses them off with clickbaity headlines and clickbaity content, distilled down into 20-second to 3-minute bite-sized pieces of content. In my opinion, this is not the best way to build authority.
Yeah. I don't know that I have anything to add to that. I think you nailed it.
Okay. So yeah, constant race for attention. I think it's still a good place to siphon off traffic and promote your content, but that's kind of a larger discussion. I wouldn't use it as your primary and only channel if you have B2B expertise that you're trying to build authority around.
I want to get your take on something that is not quite social media, but like, let's call them niche groups that could take the form of a certain forum or like a private Slack channel.
Yep.
Would be another one, or a private Facebook group, which, okay, it's tempting to call that social media. Do you see it as any different than social media? Like, it's a smaller venue, it's a smaller pond that you're interacting with. And there's some walls around it, right? Like you have to register for the forum or you have to be invited to the private Slack channel or whatever. How do you see that? Or does that fit into our number 7 of the Magnificent 7 here on networking?
That's a really good question. I hadn't thought about that and I'm glad you brought it up. I think also Reddit forums could kind of fall into this where like you have to be approved and there's a real expectation that you participate before you're sort of going there and plastering your message, like you're an actual contributor to the group.
Right.
Here's my thought about those channels. And one of the reasons I haven't used them a lot for building my own authority is it feels to me like those places are more about reaction or playing defense. So let's take a Slack channel, for instance. In order for me to build my authority, I'm not just going to go in and paste an article.
No, for sure. You have to participate like as a real person, not as like, this is a pipe that I'm pumping content out of.
That's right. It's not just a promotion channel, which means I have to invest, for me, an inordinate amount of time in order to understand the people in there, to get to know them, to react to the right things. Of course, in Slack, you can say, hey, anytime someone mentions sales or proposal or lead generation or something related to my business and my advice, I could go in and respond to them. But my overall feeling, the plus is someone already built a community for you. So if it's highly self-selected, that's great. The minus is you're basically in reactive mode, which is I tend to not favor channels like that. Like if I thought Slack was an important way for me to develop my authority, it would be much more beneficial for me to create my own Slack than to go participate in someone else's.
Well, I think I want to challenge you just a tiny bit on that. And let's imagine that your sales training was specifically for agencies of a certain size. It's not. You're going more to serve individuals. But I'm just setting up a hypothetical that's not that different from reality. And let's say there was a Slack channel that was really high quality. Maybe you created it. Maybe somebody else did. And it's full of people who are in charge of sales or business development for agencies that fit that profile, that demographic, or that size profile, let's say. And let's say that you were earlier in your career. Under those circumstances, would you see it as valuable? Because it seems to me like if you can get in there and kind of show up and like be really generous and kind of over participate, like that would be a way to bootstrap getting known. If it was like this sort of, to use a fishing analogy, a stocked pond, that seems like that might, at least for some people, really be worth the effort. You're right. It's very noisy and interrupt driven and like super distracting. But if you're in that kind of early hustle and grind stage of a business, maybe that's okay.
Look, everything's a matter of prioritization, right? So if that's the best place that you have to go find the people that you're trying to sell to, like definitely go do it. The one thing I think that LinkedIn, say, would have as an advantage over a private Slack channel is whatever you say in there will kind of live on for at least a week or so. Whereas with Slack, I think things get buried nearly instantly.
Yeah.
Right? It's like a fire hose.
Yeah, they float away downstream. Yeah.
Yeah. And like the likelihood that anybody else will see that is very low. So in some ways, it's the worst of all worlds, because not only are you in reactive mode, but it's very likely that very few people will actually see whatever you post in there. But that's my personal bias. Of course, there are people out there who are like, I built my business on Slack. And it's like, great, that's totally fine. But this is my general advice.
Yeah, I think I'm defending it a bit because I've used it. And I wouldn't now because I have other things that I think are more effective for me. But in the early days, they weren't Slack channels, they were forums where I could kind of show up and over participate and start to build a reputation, which is similar to building authority. I mean, you could build a reputation as a ding-a-ling, but I think I did all right and built a reputation as like someone who has something worth listening to about the question of specialization. Okay, moving along to networking.
All right. So networking, this isn't actually what I would consider as a way to build authority, but it's worth mentioning because I think people would ask us about it. I'd say this is how a lot of people approach building their authority, but it's really not a direct way to do it, right? Because networking is about creating enough relationships and experience. So if I go to a networking event, I meet a few people, maybe I get some referrals, maybe I pick up a client or two, I do great work, and then I want to leverage that for more work. That's more of like just a normal business. I'm going to let time and my great work take care of itself. I don't think that's really a concerted way to build your authority. So I wanted to put it on this list so that you didn't feel left out, but I also would say this is not really a great way.
You wanted to put it on there just to tear it down. I'm going to say, though, there's a variation on networking where you're connecting with, I'm going to make you cringe, Liston, you ready? You're connecting with influencers.
Uh-huh.
You know, people who have existing authority with the audience you're trying to reach, the market you're trying to serve, whatever. And so your relationship building efforts are sort of focused on them. That is sort of a different thing than what I think you rightly just kind of criticized, in that you get sort of picking a beachhead, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And those people can be tremendously helpful in introducing you to their audience or saying, gosh, this person's great. You should really check out their work. Both of which have been done about me. And it, to me, it fits the umbrella of networking. I don't think it fits really anywhere else on our list. And so that's just a variation of that that I would describe as more effective than just like peer-to-peer networking.
Yes, I agree. I mean, so we could go back to podcasts and I could say, well, I just interviewed David C. Baker and I had a couple guests who have like these big businesses and one had an acquisition. And does that give me authority because I'm next to them? So a person I would think of is, there's Lewis Howes, who's, I don't know what I would call him, I guess an author, School of Greatness. There's also Jordan Harbinger, who used to be with The Art of Charm. Are they authoritative because they interviewed authoritative people, or are they authoritative because they interviewed, picked up some attention, and then leveraged it with other content and other businesses that they created? I don't know the answer. I think we can have an argument about that. But my thought is that networking alone, what it gives you is incredible access and resources, but on its own will not build your authority for you.
Yeah, which to me kind of just gets back to the whole authority versus expertise thing. It's like, okay, yeah, I could be connected with Al Gore and he could, like, every time he speaks, say, can we have a moment of silence while we reflect on how amazing Philip Morgan is? And if I don't have the underlying expertise or like a reason for him to say that, then that's never going to happen. Or yeah, you're right. It's the context, as always, is ever important.
Now we know what you dream about, Philip.
Can we have a moment of silence and reflect on Philip Morgan's contributions to the reduction of global warming, which is really just spewing a lot of hot air. And I think that's not reducing global warming.
No, I think you're adding to the problem right now. So the last thing that is worth mentioning, and then we'll shut up because this has gone on longer than it should, is advertising. So there's a guy named Ty Lopez, who you may have heard of, who's an internet marketer. And I would argue that he has built his authority through advertising. But of course, you need content to power your advertising. What Ty Lopez does is he spends hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars on YouTube ads. And then he drives traffic to his various YouTube properties. He has videos on whatever, this or that, or interviews, and then he drives people to his email list. So advertising has a place in this, but advertising is not a medium. It's an amplification mechanism. So I think the other things we mentioned, email list, podcast, articles, speaking, video marketing, social, are still the kind of key levers that you would be able to pull. And then advertising would just allow you to get that in front of even more people.
Yeah, I think you're right. It doesn't really help if you have nothing to advertise. Like, how are you going to build authority by running an ad campaign that, I mean, what would it do? Like, just have your phone number on it? Yeah, I think you're right.
Right. So I think we covered it. So for now, that is our 30,000 foot overview of this topic and this question. And in the coming weeks, and I guess months, since we're on a weekly clip here, we'll be covering each of these more in depth. If you want us to cover any of this, or you have a specific question about how we cover it, or about email lists or podcasts or whatever, do shoot us an email and let us know. You can email me, liston@liston.io.
Yeah. And if you disagree with anything I said, email liston@liston.io.
Thank you, Philip. You're so helpful.